eating and nutrition this time, it's truly almost impossible to get team members in. I think 30 to 40% are being denied after they've been approved by WHO. And so for us, seeing, there were just a handful of us at Nasser Hospital now. We're the only compassionate witnesses because press are not allowed, media is not allowed in. We're the only international individuals that can witness the true level of what is transpiring there.
Sandra Adler-Killen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Emergency and pediatric nurse, international board certified lactation consultant, just back from Gaza. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Kevin Rabinovich. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tommy Warren, Trina Ndura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton. You can see our interviews with Mossab Abu Toha at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots. From energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerowitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the evening news, weekdays at 5 p.m. here on 90.7 KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police arrest five at a demonstration against an anti-trans speaker at Portland State University. Oregon hunger advocates push back against proposed cuts to Medicaid and SNAP. And Portland City councilors have competing visions for what to do with the Portland Clean Energy Fund. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News. For Tuesday, May 6th, 2025, I'm Josh Salem. An appearance by a former athlete protesting transgender athletes in women's sports attracted dozens of protesters to the Portland State University campus. Portland police say they made five arrests at demonstrations outside an event featuring former collegiate swimmer and conservative activist Riley Gaines, who was on a speaking tour. Gaines was a nationally ranked swimmer at the University of Kentucky. She has emerged as an outspoken opponent of transgender women competing in women's sports. Gaines was speaking at PSU's Smith Memorial Student Union yesterday as part of a nationwide tour promoting the Trump administration's Title IX policies. The ticketed event started at 6:30 p.m. with private security present. A peaceful student-led protest with close to 150 people began a half hour earlier just outside the hall on the South Park blocks. Students chanted, waved blue, pink, and white flags, and gave speeches in support of the rights of transgender people. They protested for about an hour and a half. Some 12 officers on Portland Police Bureau's rapid response team monitored the rally. A second, smaller protest, unaffiliated with the student groups who staged the earlier demonstration, formed later last night. About 40 protesters crowded around the hall's Southwest Broadway entrance. They graffitied the building's glass doors and attempted to open the locked doors. Several of the officers wore riot gear and helmets, and some protesters wore masks over their faces in a scene reminiscent of confrontations between demonstrators and police during the summer of 2020. At around 8 p.m., attendees of the event began to leave the hall through a side exit. Protesters heckled those leaving. Congressional Republicans are considering a number of proposals that would cut benefit programs that many Oregonians rely on, including SNAP and Medicaid. Oregon advocates fighting hunger say cuts would unfairly shift the cost burden to states and are urging people to take action. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Groups fighting hunger in Oregon are urging residents to speak up if they're concerned about the cuts Congress could make to food, healthcare, and housing assistance programs. Congress is considering proposals that would reduce SNAP benefits and free school meals for students, along with cuts to healthcare and rental assistance programs. About 1 in 6 Oregonians receive SNAP benefits, and about a quarter use Medicaid. Alejandro Caral with the Oregon Center for Public Policy says the proposals aren't really about cutting waste and fraud, as the Trump administration contends. Instead, says Caral, they're about tax cuts.
Extending those tax cuts from 2017 to the very rich will add to the deficit and will have a direct impact on people's lives.
Research shows policies implemented during the pandemic, like the child tax credit, led to a record drop in poverty across the country in 2021. When the policies were revoked, the nation saw a record increase in poverty the following year. One proposal on the table would reduce SNAP benefits for over 700,000 Oregonians by changing how the benefits are calculated. Another would end free school meal programs for 12 million children across the country, as well as the Summer Food Service Program. Caral believes funding these types of programs is the responsibility of the federal government.
What the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress are proposing is, in essence, playing a budget trick by shifting those costs to the state.
Congressional Republicans also aim to add more paperwork and work requirements to receive SNAP and Medicaid benefits. Caral notes creating more barriers often means fewer people get the services. He says it's essentially a way to indirectly cut popular programs that many children and lower-income Oregonians depend on.
Lack of nutrition early in life, lack of access to health care early in life have repercussions for future generations. So we have to really think about the long-term consequences of the choices that we're making today.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Portland City Council meets for the first time since Mayor Wilson debuted his plan to balance the city's budget tomorrow, Wednesday, May 7th. Portland is facing a major budget shortfall, and on Monday, Wilson's budget cuts were made public. The Permitting and Development Bureau and the Parks Department are getting the biggest cuts. The public hearing on his proposed budget will start at 2 p.m., and the public is invited to testify in person or online. Earlier in the day, on the agenda tomorrow morning, the council will hold a final vote on an appeal by the Forest Park Conservancy and others to a plan from Portland General Electric to cut down some 400 trees in the park to build new transmission lines. When the issue was heard a few weeks ago, all 12 councilors voted tentatively to uphold the appeal. If they continue that tomorrow, PGE will have to pitch another plan to the city that would have less environmental impact. City Council will hear two items on different settlements related to alleged harm done to Portlanders by the Portland police. One is from 2023, where the plaintiff alleges that his Fourth Amendment rights were violated when he was unreasonably searched by Portland police and falsely arrested. The other dates back to racial justice protests in 2020. Another plaintiff alleges she was shot with a rubber ball distraction device as she was leaving a protest in compliance with police instructions. If council approves, those combined payouts will be nearly $500,000. A number of Portland city councilors have looked at the Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PCEF, as a possible antidote to the city's budget woes. PCEF is funded by a 1% tax on large national retailers. Those funds are set aside for climate resilience projects with a focus on frontline communities. It's outperformed expectations, and during last year's budget shortfall, some of its funds were applied to the Bureau of Transportation's budget hole and other city projects. Councilor Eric Zimmerman expresses interest in taking from PCEF to fund city services in the general fund, like parks, houseless services, the fire department, and police. Councilors Steve Novick, Jamie Dunphy, and Angelita Murillo have proposed tweaking the PCEF tax, increasing it to 1 1/3%, and applying that last third to the city's general fund. That strategy would leave the main funding mechanism intact, and it would mean the city does not need to go back to the voters for approval. The 0.3% tax on major national retailers could bring in $60 million to the city. Now, there's another proposal for how PSEF could factor into the city's budget shortfall. Councilor Mitch Green wants the city to take out a short-term loan from the unspent PSEF funds to pay for parks maintenance. Parks maintenance is on the chopping block in Mayor Wilson's budget. Green's loan would borrow between $20 and $80 million to help avoid, quote, unacceptable cuts in the city's budget. He says it would buy time for leaders to figure out bigger solutions to more overarching budget problems. Green says the loan would help protect PSEF from other attempts to raid the fund, especially as its work on carbon reduction becomes all the more important. Portland City Councilors are expected to publicly weigh in on Mayor Wilson's budget at their meeting tomorrow. The Trump administration offers $1,000 to undocumented migrants to self-deport. Democrats oppose Social Security changes in Trump's pick to lead the agency. And Congress debates unpopular easing of limits on oil and gas drilling on public lands. With those stories and more, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We will give you this money that you can leave today. It's the safest way. You will not be arrested. You will not be detained. And we will give you that free flight.
Homeland Security spokesperson Trisha McLaughlin says as immigration enforcement intensifies, the government will pay unauthorized migrants $1,000 to self-deport. Each forced deportation costs taxpayers more than $17,000. President Donald Trump's harsh policies and rhetoric has seemed to reduce the number trying to get in, and a few are already leaving on their own. Democratic Arizona Senator Ruben Gallegos says it would be better for illegal immigrants to pay a $5,000 fine, go through a background check, and get work visas, dependent on good behavior. Surprising many, the White House is asking a federal court to drop a case against abortion medications. The case, brought by several red states, would have reverse broad access to the medicines granted by the FDA. Meanwhile, the administration has asked the Supreme Court to grant DOJ access to sensitive Social Security data. Democrats and senior groups are protesting that, as well as the nomination of Frank Bisignano to lead the agency. Nancy Altman is the president of the advocacy group Social Security Works.
And I can tell you, it's gone through wars, pandemic. It has never seen a threat like Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and Frank Bisignano. They are decimating Social Security.
Billionaire Elon Musk has promoted the falsehood that millions of dead Americans are getting checks, which Altman says comes from basic mistakes about the system. The full Senate will vote on Bisignano today. Senate Democrats want much stronger consumer protections in a cryptocurrency bill. They say the current legislation would aid Trump family efforts to profit from crypto. The president has drawn scorn for offering to host people who buy large holdings in his private firm at the White House. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is ordering the number of high-ranking military officers be cut by a fifth. There are now nearly 40 four-star generals and admirals. The House Committee on Natural Resources is considering reversing Biden-era limits on public land, oil and gas leasing. But Russell Coleman with the Nevada Wildlife Federation says new polling finds most Westerners oppose more drilling.
Our habitat and wildlife populations are starting to show that ignoring conservation, sustainability, and sound science have a price.
Activists with the 5501 movement say they'll protest against Trump this summer. Alisa Advani with the Indiana chapter says they plan on expanding beyond state houses and into smaller communities.
It's a national group. It was designed specifically so that there would be coordinated protests in every state on the same day, and it's grown exponentially.
Finally, Canada's new prime minister is set to visit the White House. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick says the meeting could end the trade war, but calls the negotiations really complex. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU's News in Depth. At 6, it's Trans-Positive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with lows in the 50s. In tomorrow's weather, we'll see cloudy skies with periods of rain later in the day and highs at 72 degrees. Today in history, the Eiffel Tower was officially opened to the public in Paris. The Eiffel Tower was a symbol of resilience during World War II, and it shapes France's cultural identity, giving Paris the nickname the City of Light. The quote of the day is from Maximilien Robespierre, a French lawyer who played an influential role in the French Revolution. He said, "No one loves armed missionaries. The first lesson of nature and prudence is to repulse them as enemies." Advocates say having a statewide democracy voucher program would strengthen Washington's democracy and keep big money out of politics. Since launching in Seattle in 2017, data show the program has been a success. Isabel Chorley joins us once again with the details.
Seattle City Council voted last week to put the city's Democracy Voucher program on the ballot to be renewed in August, and supporters of the program are looking to take it statewide. Launched in 2017, the program gives each resident four $25 vouchers to donate to participating candidates. Data shows the program has boosted voter turnout, increased small donors fivefold, and encouraged more women and people of color to run. Spencer Olson of the nonprofit People Powered Election Seattle says voucher program counter nationwide voting rights rollbacks and model a more inclusive democracy.
It's proof that we can reduce the influence of big money, can expand participation, and can give regular people a stronger voice and who represents them.
People Powered Elections has been working on a bill for next session that would bring democracy vouchers to Washington's state legislative races. Participating candidates must get a minimum number of signatures and small donations to qualify and must adhere to contribution and spending limits. Critics of the program say it creates new avenues for corruption because candidates will be motivated to lie about where the contributions come from. Olson says so far in Seattle, there has been no evidence of widespread misuse or fraud, adding there are robust legal safeguards in place.
Anyone who commits theft, forgery, trafficking, or unlawful transfers of democracy vouchers face steep penalties and fines and up to time in jail.
Olson says Seattle's success has inspired interest from other cities and counties. He adds a statewide voucher program for legislative elections could create infrastructure to expand it locally, helping smaller communities hold more competitive races.
I used to live over in Kittitas County for many years, and it was very common to have an uncontested election or not even have anyone run for local office.
Olson adds a bill to bring a voucher program to Washington state elections will be introduced next year. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Tribes in Alaska have had to cancel their annual traditional food distribution because their federal funding was canceled. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska have announced the tribe's annual traditional food distributions were canceled this year. In March, the federal government canceled a funding agreement with the tribe. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports.
Springtime is herring egg season in southeast Alaska. Usually that means the region's largest tribal government will be setting up to deliver tens of thousands of pounds of the traditional food to tribal citizens across the region and beyond. But this year, those distributions won't be happening. For the last 3 years, the tribe distributed herring eggs, salmon, and black cod in each of its recognized communities, from villages in southeast to cities like Anchorage and Seattle. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture canceled funding that provided the tribe's food assistance program. A USDA notice to Tlingit and Haida said that the tribe's community food distribution, quote, no longer effectuates agency priorities and that termination of the award is appropriate, unquote. Aaron Angerman is Tlingit and Haida's food security program manager. He said the community distribution program started in 2022 to promote self-sufficiency and to reduce reliance on food shipped from the lower 48.
Our answer to that, and then our heavy reliance on barge systems and things like that, was to turn back the clock a bit, promote food sovereignty, which is something that our people have relied on since time immemorial.
The money was part of a program called the Local Food Purchase Assistance Agreement, which was intended to encourage local governments to buy from farmers and food producers. And that aligned with the tribe's goal to keep more traditional foods that are harvested in southeast Alaska in the fridges and freezers of tribal members. Angerman said his team is working to get more secure funding, but there's a lot of other work they're doing to further the understanding and use of traditional foods in the meantime.
We need to work with elders and those with traditional ecological knowledge to see why and where and how we harvested previously, then to not only do that, but to teach people how to harvest themselves, how to process that food, how to put up or prepare that food.
Some distributions in Washington and Oregon will still happen, according to the tribe's release. The local tribal council in Seattle used different funding sources to set aside money for distributions to reach elders outside of Alaska. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cromerie.
On the heels of a busy Montana legislative session, the advocacy group Western Native Voice is setting its sights higher and opening a Washington, D.C. office next week. Kathleen Shannon has more.
The nonprofit formed in 2022 to advocate for equity and opportunity for Montana's Native people. Since then, the group has gained members in and collaborated with tribes across many Western states. Director of Government and Political Relations Keaton Sunchild says it can be difficult to operate at a national level from 2,000 miles away.
So being able to be right there, be on top of the action, and be able to use our voice in Washington is going to help us be a little bit more proactive.
He says top issues at the national level include criminal justice funding for missing and murdered Indigenous people and drug crises that disproportionately impact tribal communities. Sunchild says the national office will open next Monday, May 12th. Sunchild calls the Montana session pretty successful for Western Native Voice, but he says one area of continued concern is voting rights. Governor Greg Gianforte is expected to decide Tuesday on Senate Bill 490, which would add restrictions to same-day voter registration.
The road we've been down before. So trying to figure out the best way forward for that, whether that's through the courts in Montana, or maybe if there's some sort of backstop we could look at federally.
Other voting access issues Sunchild says he plans to work on are funding for more satellite elections offices and blanket protections for tribal IDs as valid voter registration identification. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
Events were held across the country Monday to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous people. Leaders of the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs also recognized the day. U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski, chair of the committee, and Brian Schatz, vice chair, acknowledged the families and communities who have lost loved ones and said actions need to continue to raise awareness and seek justice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
There's a more climate-friendly way to heat your shower. Heat pump water heaters are efficient and they run on electricity. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. People use warm water for everything from scrubbing dishes to relaxing in the bath, so water heaters are one of the biggest energy draws in a home. But with the latest technology, you can get hot water while saving on your utility bills. Wesley Whited of DNV, a global consulting firm, says new electric heat pump water heaters operate more efficiently than standard electric resistance models.
They're removing heat from the air and transferring it into the water instead of directly heating an element, which is the way we've historically always heated our hot water.
He says they're most attractive to people who live in the Pacific Northwest and California, where hot water is already typically heated with electricity instead of natural gas.
It's a lot easier when you already have an electric resistance water heater to move to a heat pump water heater because you have the circuiting in place.
The devices do have a higher upfront cost, but there are often rebates and incentives available for buyers, and homeowners can expect to save money over time. According to the EPA, switching to a heat pump water heater that is ENERGY STAR certified can save a family of four more than $500 each year. And by reducing your home's energy use, you'll help the climate, too. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Donald Trump's strategy for weakening China couples very high tariffs not just on that country, but also on Southeast Asian countries that Chinese and multinational companies might use for re-exporting products to the U.S. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. He says China is already working around that strategy, making it harder than ever for Trump to keep pretending he does not need to talk with Xi Jinping. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Donald Trump, in his second time around as president, has rejected finding common ground as the basis for relations with China. Following the Project 2025 script on China, specifically Peter Navarro's section on trade relations, Trump has made a tariff war and economic decoupling the essence of his China policy. In direct contrast, Beijing, along with the European Union, has become the leading exponent of economic globalization, multilateralism, negotiations to lower trade barriers, promotion of free trade agreements, and assurance of supply chains. To China's not-so-quiet satisfaction, Trump has put the U.S. on the outside of the system, looking in and finding few allies. Trump's public argument for the tariffs is twofold. U.S. trade partners with the highest trade surpluses must lower their tariffs on U.S. imports, and U.S. and other multinational firms must move their manufacturing back to the U.S. if they want to avoid tariffs. China, with a trade surplus with the U.S. of around $295 billion, is the leading target. The Trump strategy comes down to this. If China does not lower its tariffs on U.S. imports, China and U.S. companies based in China will have to seek alternative markets in neighboring countries, and in doing so, they will fail. That's because Trump is banking on high tariffs on Southeast Asian countries to thwart China's effort to redirect its export platform. That's why Trump not only imposed a 145% tariff on Chinese goods, but also 46% on Vietnam, 49% on Cambodia, 24% on Malaysia, and 36% on Thailand. A White House official said, quote, "Once you see a lot of countries, not just in Southeast Asia or Asia, but all over, you'll see that they're willing to make deals with America, and that exerts pressure on China to hopefully come to the table. The question is, will it?" China's total trade with 10 countries of Southeast Asia came to about $900 billion, double the U.S. level. In the new circumstances, China is well situated to strengthen its position further in the regional trade order. So shortly after Trump announced his high tariffs on April 2nd, Xi Jinping visited Vietnam, Cambodia, and Malaysia, emphasizing solidarity against U.S., quote, unilateralism and hegemonism. He received lavish welcomes and signed multiple deals that covered cultural and scientific exchanges, as well as trade. Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim told Xi, quote, "In the face of unilateralism, meaning America, Malaysia wishes to strengthen cooperation with China and together deal with risks and challenges. The ASEAN, that is the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, cannot approve of any unilateral method of imposing tariffs." Not only is China getting the better of the United States and Southeast Asia, a number of international companies, rather than deciding to relocate back to the United States, are either staying in China or they are finding other places to do production. For example, Apple. It has decided to move its production facilities for the iPhone to India. Some observers have speculated that Trump's heavy tariffs on China were designed to force Xi Jinping to the bargaining table at a summit meeting, where a new trade deal favorable to the U.S. would be worked out. But that has turned out to be a sadly mistaken reading of Chinese thinking. Bullying China, a favorite theme in Beijing, doesn't work. A spokesman for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said, "China's attitude is consistent and clear. If you want to fight, we will fight to the end. If you want to talk, the door is open." For now, to use a favorite Chinese expression, they are taking advantage of another's misfortunes. In an ideal world, Trump would pick up the phone and start a conversation with Xi. But Trump, in an interview with Time magazine on April 22nd, said he wouldn't call Xi and insisted that actually Xi had called him. That's highly unlikely. Xi has gone off in another direction. Yet Trump agrees with his Treasury Secretary that the current situation with China is, quote, not sustainable. But he has not offered China a way out. His grievances stand in the way. He said, for instance, of the Chinese, oh, there's a number at which they will feel comfortable. But you can't let them make $1 trillion from us. You can't let them make $750 billion. See, that's really what's not sustainable when China makes $1 trillion or $1.1 trillion, when we have almost $2 trillion worth of loss. In that same Time interview, Trump pretended that ending trade with China involves little more sacrifice than Americans buying fewer dolls at Christmas. J.D. Vance offered another slight when he explained why globalization worked against the U.S. To make things clear, he said, we borrow money from Chinese peasants to buy the things those Chinese peasants manufacture. Belittling China, just as Trump belittles Canada, who needs them after all, is either pretense or utter stupidity at a time when the U.S. and China economies are so deeply intertwined. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 6th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, and Dejan. Their producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the Air Room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the Air Room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.